Dr. J. Robert Benoit, Professor of Old Testament at Biblical Theological Seminary.
My topic is the use of archaeology in the interpretation and understanding of the Scripture. This, of course, is an enormous subject, the relationship of archaeology and the study of the Bible. I will not attempt, and of course could by no means begin to survey the entire scope of this particular subject. But certainly there is little question that archaeological research has had an important influence on the study of the Bible in the past 50 to 75 years. Through the results of archaeological research, our knowledge of the cultural background to the Bible has been greatly enhanced. And the beneficial result of this is that we can place ourselves more completely and with greater understanding in the world in which the biblical events took place and in which the accounts of them were written. Along with that general enlightenment with respect to the setting of the biblical narratives, there has also developed a much more positive attitude toward the historical reliability of biblical history, as various features of the historical sections of the Bible, both Old and New Testaments, have been demonstrated to fit precisely with the times about which they speak. And that, of course, is significant when you place that fact in the context of the general trend of biblical studies over the past century. In 1958, William Foxwell Albright made this statement. William Foxwell Albright, some of you may know, was a professor of archaeology and ancient history and languages at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore for many years. He died very recently. An enormously influential scholar in this particular area of study. And he made this statement: thanks to modern research, we now recognize the Bible's substantial historicity. The narratives of the patriarchs, Moses, the Exodus, of the conquest of Canaan, of the judges, the monarchy, the exile, and the restoration have all been confirmed and illuminated to an extent that I should have thought impossible 40 years ago. Now, he spoke that in 1958. That's 20 years ago, of course, now. But what he's referring to is the very real change from the early part of this century, the early 1900s, when we come to the middle part of the century. And he says that there has been this change that enables him then to speak of the substantial historicity of the Scripture in all of these areas, moving from the patriarchs through to the time of the exile in respect to the Old Testament. Now, that kind of a statement is in great contrast to the prevailing opinion in the field of Old Testament studies in the early part of the century. At about the turn of the century, a man named Julius Wellhausen, a German professor who wrote many works of history and criticism, particularly of the Old Testament, although his labor was not confined to the Old Testament, he also dealt with the New Testament. He said, for example, of the patriarchal narratives in one of his most important writings, the Prolegomena to the History of Ancient Israel, he said this: it is true we attain to no historical knowledge of the patriarchs, but only of the time when the stories about them arose in the Israelite people. This later age is here unconsciously projected in its inner and outward features into hoar antiquity and is reflected there like a glorified mirage. Now, what Wellhausen was saying was that when you read in Genesis about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and you read of those patriarchs, you are reading stories that were written in the time of the exile, or maybe even later than the exile, which would have been 1,500 years, a millennium and a half after the time of Abraham. And he says that those stories then tell us nothing really historical about the time of Abraham. All they do is reflect the time of the exile, many centuries later. And that these writers who wrote these many centuries later sort of reflected their own times, projected them back into earlier times, so that we really can't think that we know anything historical about the patriarchs, about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Or note his comment in the same book about some of the narratives in 1 Samuel, where the story of the rise of kingship is told in Israel. He says, quote, "There cannot be a word of truth in the whole narrative," speaking of what he called an anti-monarchical strand that he found in 1 Samuel that was a late composition. And that strand he found in 1 Samuel chapter 8, 1 Samuel chapter 10, and 1 Samuel chapter 12. He says there cannot be a word of truth in the whole narrative. Why? It's written so long after the event, reflects later ideas, later times. It's represented as being historical, but it's not. Why this change? Here was Wellhausen, the early part of the century, making statements like that. Albright comes along in the middle of this century, in the 1950s, and says that we can now talk about the substantial historicity of the Old Testament narrative. The biggest single force in reversing at least many of the biblical scholars in their attitude towards the historical reliability of the Old Testament has been the results of archaeological research. G. Ernest Wright of Harvard Divinity School, who also passed away just recently, made this statement. He says, "It is indeed true that archaeology has revolutionized our attitude toward biblical historical traditions. A previous generation of scholars was inclined to make skepticism an important element in historical method, an almost primary ingredient in the conclusions drawn from the use of the method. Today, many of us take a far more positive line and are inclined to give a tradition the benefit of the doubt, unless there is evidence to the contrary. This is a basic and all-important scholarly shift in viewpoints, and archaeology is its cause." Why that shift? Archaeology and the results of it that have shown that there is reason to accept these narratives as fitting with the times in which they represent themselves to speak about. It's not possible, as I mentioned earlier, to discuss today the history of archaeological research or to discuss its many findings as they relate to biblical history and interpretation. But I'd like to focus our attention on the use of archaeology in the interpretation and understanding of Scripture. The use of archaeology. How do we go about using it? As we've noted, archaeology has proven to be of enormous benefit for the study of biblical history. And it's likely that it will continue to be so. And it's likely that it will continue to throw surprising new light on the biblical narratives in the future. I think everyone is waiting with great expectation and great curiosity at what the results of the excavations at the place called Ebla in Syria will bring forth. Maybe some of you have heard about these finds. Just in the last few years, thousands of tablets have been discovered in a library that was burned in a place called Ebla, which was previously an unknown of place. And the texts that have been found, they're written in a new language. It's been deciphered at this point. There are a couple of men working on these texts. They date to several centuries prior to the time of Abraham. And from what has been told of the contents of these texts, although none of the texts themselves have yet been published, from what has been told, many names that appear in the Genesis narratives, both of individuals and of cities, appear on these texts. Now, of course, of individuals, that doesn't necessarily mean that the individual with the same name that's mentioned in the Bible is the same person mentioned on the text. But we know that the name was used at that particular time then, and here would be an extra biblical confirmation of that. Place names are a bit different. When you come to some of the places mentioned that are very obscure places and which have not been really identified yet, that are mentioned in Genesis. And then you find them in these extra-biblical texts. It, of course, serves also to undergird the reliability of the biblical text. But as of yet, that's all speculation as to what will come out of the Eblit text. They haven't been published yet. And there's a lot of political intrigue going on right at the moment about the release and the publication of these by the Syrian government. But I think there is good reason, looking at the past, seeing what has happened, that we will continue to find exciting new developments as archaeologists continue in their work in many different areas. And this is just one. But I think what I... Question.
Could you give us your definition of biblical archaeology?
Biblical archaeology, yeah. I think that archaeology, just speak generally, archaeology treats with remains from the past, particularly of two types. There are written remains, and there are material remains that don't have writing. There are foundations of walls, there are statues, there are figurines, there's clay pottery, there are all kinds of non-literary remains. But an archaeologist is someone who attempts to recover those remains of earlier civilizations, both written and non-written, and then from them to try to relate them to what may be known about that place and to reconstruct the life and the history of the people that utilize these materials. Now, biblical archaeology, of course, would, I think, simply do the same thing, but it would be interested in those materials that in some way have a connection with the Bible, either Old or New Testament. That connection may be rather direct. It may be very indirect. In other words, just to give you an illustration, there were a lot of texts found at a place called Mari, which is in Mesopotamia. It's a long way from Palestine. But those texts, as far as some of the things that they mention, have certain parallels to things that are mentioned in the Old Testament, even though both in time and geography, they're quite a ways removed from the specific events mentioned in the Old Testament. So we still, I think, could include something like the Mari text in biblical archaeology because of the indirect relation they have on Old Testament study. But what I want to focus your attention on this afternoon is the role of archaeology in biblical studies and the use of archaeology in biblical studies and the necessity to develop a proper perspective in connection with the use of archaeology in the study of the scripture. I think we ought to think about what it is that archaeology can and cannot do with respect to the understanding and interpretation of scripture. What are the limits of what we can expect from archaeology? What can it do? What can it not do? I think it's very important from the outset to realize that archaeologists do not always speak with unanimity in their own conclusions. You may sort of have the impression the archaeologists say as if they're all agreeing on everything they say. It's not always the case. I think it is important that we do not elevate archaeological research to a position where its supposedly assured and scientific results, put that in quotes, its assured and scientific results rule over the scripture and then offer the last word, as it were, in questions of historical interpretation. Must we go to the archaeologists in order to find out if the Bible is true? Does archaeology have the last word? Sometimes too much importance has been given to archaeology as a sort of court of final appeal for establishing the accuracy or inaccuracy of some historical statement in the Bible. I think we have to be very careful of that. It's then important that we develop an understanding of how archaeology can function as an aid in biblical studies without either expecting too much from it on the one hand or minimizing its importance on the other. It certainly has and certainly should continue to perform an important function. So we don't want to minimize that function. But on the other hand, we don't want to exalt archaeology to some sort of final word on every question of historical interpretation of the Old Testament. In other words, the biblical student must make a critical use of archaeology, a use characterized by discernment and carefulness in drawing conclusions. And in view of that, I would like to focus your attention here for a good part of our discussion on two principles that should always be remembered when one attempts to utilize archaeological research in the study of biblical history. Two principles that will help, I think, in giving perspective on the use of archaeology. The first of these principles is that archaeological evidence is of necessity very fragmentary in nature. Archaeological evidence is of necessity very fragmentary in nature. We must remember that by the very nature of the discipline itself, we will only have available a fraction of the evidence which we might desire to have at our disposal on any given question. The importance of this principle, particularly in view of the tendency of some to regard an unconfirmed tradition in the Bible as suspect, is very great. There has been that tendency among many students of the Bible. If there's some historical statement in the Bible and we don't find archaeological confirmation for it, then that statement is suspect. That is a very dangerous procedure. Edwin Yamauchi has demonstrated in a very vivid way, I believe, the fragmentary nature of archaeological evidence in his book, The Stones and the Scriptures. And Yamauchi points out the following. He points out that first, only a fraction of what is made or written ever survives. And that can be illustrated in many ways. Perishable materials, such as papyri, have completely disappeared from many sites, particularly in Palestine, where the climate is often damp and the material simply disintegrates. In some areas, even stone inscriptions disintegrate with time. It's reasonable to expect that the kings of Israel and Judah erected stone inscriptions, much as the Moabite kings did. We have the Moabite stone, which is an inscription of King Mesha of Moab, who reigned about the time of Ahab in Israel. It's reasonable to expect that the Israelite kings did much the same, yet we do not have a single stone inscription, stela, from an Israelite king. Yamauchi points out that there were hundreds of synagogues in Palestine in the New Testament era, but only one synagogue from before 70 AD has been discovered. So that only a fraction of what is ever written or ever produced survives. Ruins in the ancient world have often been mined, much as a quarry is, for building stones or building materials, for new buildings. And the materials become reused somewhere else, and what evidence there might have been of a particular culture at a particular time simply disappears. There are many illustrations of that. The natural forces of erosion and decay also have a factor in this. The second point that Mr. Yamauchi points out is that only a fraction of the available sites have ever been surveyed. In 1944, the Palestine Gazette listed a total of about 3,000 sites in the area west of the Jordan River. Now, what I mean by sites is the identification of an ancient locality being located and named. There were about 3,000 of these sites identified in the area west of the Jordan River in 1944, several hundred in Transjordan. By 1963, the total of known sites had increased to about 5,000 identified sites. They were largely the result of the surveys of Nelson Gluck. By 1966 to 67, some new surveys turned up 200 new sites. And then the Israeli surveys in 67 and 68 in the occupied Golan Heights in Samaria and Judea, what is now called the West Bank, substantially increased the total. Dr. Moshe Kokavi, director of the Judean Survey, writes, our survey surveyed 1,200 sites, of which some 20 to 30% are new sites previously unrecorded. I estimate that there are not more than one-third of the amount of possible sites recorded, and a thorough survey is a question of many years. All told, close to 2,000 sites were examined by the Israeli teams, of which about 800 were previously unknown. So that the second thing to keep in mind is that only a fraction of available sites have even been surveyed. Now, to survey a site is simply to identify it. It's not to excavate it. It's simply to list it, to know that here's a site that was occupied in ancient times. Frequently, there'll be a mound or something to indicate. Sometimes there's very little indication left of where these sites were. Thirdly, only a fraction of the surveyed sites have been excavated. In 1963, Paul Lapp estimated that of 5,000 sites in Palestine, there had been scientific excavations at about 150 sites. 5,000 identified sites, excavations at 150. And of the 150, there were 26 major excavations. So you see that the ratio is very small. Paul Lapp qualified that statement, and certainly it should be qualified, by noting, to be sure, many of the sites on record would not merit extensive excavation. But if only 1 in 4 were promising, major excavations have till now been carried out at only 2% of the potential sites. So even discounting the fact that of the 5,000, there may be many of those that wouldn't be worthy of a full-scale excavation. If only 1 in 4, you're still down to a very small percentage of potential sites being excavated. Fourthly, with few exceptions, only a fraction of any excavated site has actually been examined. The exceptions to that principle are the small and short-lived locations such as Qumran and Masada. They were occupied for a rather brief period of time in a rather small area, and a place like Qumran has been completely excavated. A place like Masada, that fortress on the top of the rock where the Jews resisted the Romans, that has been rather completely excavated. But with exceptions of those small and short-lived sites, only a fraction of any excavated site has actually been examined in most instances. Between 1925 and 1934, for 9 years, the Oriental Institute of the University of Chicago sponsored excavations at Megiddo and succeeded in removing the top 4 layers or strata of that mound. And the idea was they were going to take this, which was a fairly large site, take this whole mound and just work right down through it, layer by layer, century by century of time of occupation. Well, they got down through the top 4 strata, but eventually they abandoned that procedure and it's not been attempted of any site of comparable size since. It's an enormously time-consuming and expensive operation to excavate in that way. This means, however, that any excavation, even on a very important site, may miss very important findings simply because they dig trenches or they take a small area and excavate that area rather carefully and in great detail because they think it is an important place on the larger site. But their judgment may be wrong. They may have picked the wrong spot. It's, as Ed Yamauchi mentions, it's embarrassing to report that a cuneiform text of the Gilgamesh epic was found by shepherds in the discarded debris from the excavations at Megiddo. So even when you have archaeologists attempting to be very careful, they can miss things. Garstang concluded from his work at Hatzor in the north in 1928 that the site was not an important city in the 14th and 13th centuries B.C., because there was no Mycenaean imported pottery to be found there, a pottery typical of that particular period of time. And of course that created a problem, because the book of Joshua says that Joshua led the armies of Israel in the conquest up against Hatzor, and it was the strongest and most important city in the north at that time. City's excavated, there's no pottery of a particular type there of that particular time, and the excavator concludes it wasn't inhabited during that time. And yet, Yadin, who was excavated more recently, in that same site, has found floors littered with Mycenaean pottery. Garstang wasn't excavating in the right spot. Hatzor is a comparatively large site, particularly for Canaanite cities. It has an upper city of about 30 acres and a lower city of about 175 acres, so it's a site of about 200 acres. Working with a large staff, an unusually large staff, of more than 30 archaeologists and a crew of more than 100 laborers, Yadin managed to clear 1/400th of the site in four seasons of work, 1955 to 58. That's 1/1600th of the site per season. He suggested it would take 800 years of 4 or 5 months' work to clear the entire site. They work when they're not disturbed by rain, usually during the summer. But it'd take 800 years if you were going to systematically clear that site of Hatzor. Other sites in the ancient Near East that do relate to biblical material, such as Babylon, are much, much larger. Hatzor is 200 acres. Babylon is 2,500 acres. Nineveh, 1,850 acres. At Yadin's estimated rate of progress for Hatzor, it would take 8,000 years to excavate Babylon, totally, systematically, going through the whole site. So that only, with few exceptions, only a fraction of any excavated site has really been examined. Fifthly, only a fraction of the materials, and especially inscriptions, produced by excavations has been published. Because of the scarcity of scholars who were able to translate these texts and to publish them, and because of the cost of their publication, because of the little demand for such publication, there's often an enormous time lag between the discovery of the texts and their availability through publication, if they become available at all. A Babylonian king list acquired in the 1880s by the British Museum was published in 1954, 75 years before the text was published. Tablets of the Lippitt-Ishtar Law Code, excavated by the University of Pennsylvania in the late 1800s, were on the shelves of the University of Pennsylvania Museum in Philadelphia until Francis R. Steele happened to discover one of these and see its significance, and he published them in 1947. So that for over 50 years, here were these tablets of a law code that was prior to the time of Moses. Very important discovery. And it was over 50 years in the University of Pennsylvania Museum, and nobody even knew it was there. The curator of Akkadian language at the University of Pennsylvania Museum says, quote, "With few exceptions, Western museums have still not caught up with the flow of antiquities, and their basements and storerooms are full of undiscovered treasures. In the field of Assyriology, of course, we rely almost entirely on existing collections of cuneiform tablets rather than on new excavations. We have absorbed such a small percentage of the hundreds of thousands of tablets in museums that new discoveries are almost routine." And that's not by excavating, that's by looking in the archives of the museums. "In a tablet collection the size of the one at the University Museum, every drawer holds a surprise. The only problem is which drawer to open. Samuel Kramer of the University of Pennsylvania estimated that about 10% of the approximately 500,000 cuneiform texts recovered have been published. So that of all the tablets, thousands, multiplied thousands of them, about 10% have ever been published. Illustrations of this could be multiplied. Of the Assyrian letters found at Nineveh, about 2,000 are unpublished. They're still in the British Museum. Most of the tablets found at Eshnunna remain unpublished. Publication of the findings at Ur of the Chaldees by Woolley of the University of Pennsylvania in the 1930s have still not been completed. And as I mentioned, such publications are costly. There are few people who can do it. There are few people who want to fund that kind of work. And it's not likely that that is going to change very quickly. In the new Ebla material, there's a great interest in that. But up to this point, there hasn't been a single text published, and it may be the next generation before that material really becomes available. So that we must always remember the fragmentary character of archaeological findings when we utilize them for a corroboration of biblical history. By the nature of the discipline itself, we will only ever have available a fraction of 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 the material that we might wish to have. And you see that in these five fractions you just multiply. And you see that when you do get a finding that relates to something specific in the biblical text, you have a remarkable exception to what you might ordinarily expect. Ed Yamauchi has diagrammed this situation this way. I think that's helpful. He speaks of circles of evidence. As I mentioned earlier in this question that was asked about archaeological findings are basically of two types: literary remains and material remains. And if you diagram the situation as you see out there on the screen, you find that there are material remains such as buildings, monuments, pottery, statues, etc. There are literary remains, writings on monuments, letters, legal documents, court annals, various types of literary material. And if you plot the biblical record then, or the biblical text, as another circle, and you make those circles overlapping, you see that there can be seven possible combinations. Three in which one source stands alone, and in fact the majority of the material you would expect to stand alone. And then three in which two sources overlap. You may have an overlapping of the biblical text and material remains, or the biblical text and literary remains, or maybe of literary and material remains outside of the Bible. And then the ideal but very unique and exceptional situation in which the three sources overlap, and you have material, literary remains, and also something in the biblical text that relates to the same point. As I mentioned earlier, there have been those who have assumed that the historicity of a person or an event or even a place or something mentioned in the biblical text is suspect unless it is corroborated by archaeological findings, by some extra-biblical inscription or something of that sort. For example, there's a man mentioned in the book of Daniel called Darius the Mede. And we don't know of Darius the Mede from extra-biblical sources. Who was he? Now, many critics of the book of Daniel have suggested this is just a complete error in the book. Whoever wrote the book lived much later. It's a historical error. Methodologically, it is a bad principle to assume that some statement in the Bible is incorrect unless corroborated by archaeological findings. For this very reason, we shouldn't expect corroboration of most of the statements in the Bible. Where we do find corroboration is something that's exciting, but it is the thing that is the exception. If we had to depend on inscriptional evidence to prove the historicity of Pontius Pilate, we would have had to wait until 1961, when the first epigraphical documentation concerning him was discovered at Caesarea, outside of the scripture. The first epigraphical attestation of Herod the Great was discovered in 1963 to 65 in the excavations of Masada, and other illustrations of this sort could be mentioned. So it is procedurally improper to question or deny historical reliability of biblical statements on the basis of the lack of inscriptional or material corroborating evidence from archaeological research. Now, that's the first principle, this fragmentary character of archaeological findings. All right, a second principle that should always be remembered when one attempts to utilize archaeological research in the study of biblical history is that in many cases, the interpretation of what archaeological evidence there is may be only tentative. We have fragmentary evidence. But now put on top of that this principle, that in many cases the interpretation of what archaeological evidence we do have may be only tentative and subject to revision or reinterpretation in the light of additional evidence. So the tentative nature of the interpretation of archaeological evidence, another important principle. I think it's here that caution is extremely important. And that caution has application to both those things which certain archaeologists have used against the accuracy of the Bible, as well as to instances which others have cited or used to, quote, prove the Bible's historical accuracy. You have to be careful, no matter how you're using the evidence. Whether you're using it to prove the Bible or to disprove the Bible, be very careful in how you interpret the evidence. Different types of archaeological evidence must be read with different degrees of certainty concerning their interpretation. Interpretations of archaeological evidence may range from doubtful to possible or probable to certain, depending on the nature of the evidence. You have an inscriptional remain that spells something out very clearly, and it's clearly linked with a particular time and particular context on the site. There's not too much problem with interpretation. But if you don't have that kind of evidence, you simply have some foundations of some building, or you have a fragment of pottery or whatever, interpretation becomes a very important factor in using the evidence you have. Now, some illustrations of this. We know, for example, from 1 Kings 10, 26 to 29, that Solomon traded in horses and chariots. We know that Solomon built up his own military establishment. But 1 Kings 10:26 reads, "And Solomon gathered together chariots and horsemen. And he had 1,400 chariots, 1,200 horsemen, whom he bestowed in the cities for chariots and with the king at Jerusalem." Verse 28, "Solomon had horses brought out of Egypt and Kuwait. The king's merchants received them from Kuwait at a price. A chariot came up and went out of Egypt for 600 shekels of silver, and a horse for 150. And so for all the kings of the Hittites and for the kings of Syria did they bring them out by their means." We know that Megiddo was one of the important building sites of Solomon. As I mentioned earlier, Megiddo is one of the sites in Palestine that has been excavated rather carefully. In 1925, the excavations sponsored by the University of Chicago were begun, and they worked down, as I mentioned, through those early or top layers of the mound. And the first layer was from the time of the Persian and Babylonian empires, about the 6th century B.C., it'd be late time in biblical history. The second layer, Assyrian rule, about the 8th century B.C., they got down to the third and the fourth layers, and they were in the Israelite period, of the kingdom period. After about 9 seasons of digging, they came to what they thought was the time of Solomon. And in that layer, they found remains of rather strange buildings, the chief unique feature of which was a row of pillars with holes through the top of these pillars. If you pick up almost any handbook on archaeology or encyclopedic article, you'll probably see a reference to this and maybe even a picture of these stone columns with the holes through the top. The director, a man named Mr. Guy, came to the conclusion that these were stables, the buildings in which these pillars were, and that the pillars were hitching posts, which at the same time served as roof supports. And that this hole had something to do with hitching the horses to these posts. And that was then used as archaeological corroboration of a number of things. Solomon's chariot cities, mentioned in 1 Kings 9:19, which mentions Megiddo. His trade in chariots and horses that we read there in 1 Kings 10:26-29, and then his building operations itself at Megiddo in 1 Kings 9:15. And that discovery was frequently cited as corroboration for these biblical statements. Here's extra biblical corroboration for Solomon and his stables and his horses. That whole thesis, however, today is under question because of a reinterpretation of the evidence involved. In 1970, James Pritchard of the University of Pennsylvania wrote an article entitled "The Megiddo Stables, a Reassessment." And he, among others, have reviewed the evidence, and they've abandoned the previous conclusion that these were stables. And because of comparable types of buildings found elsewhere in a variety of regions, some of them rather technical, they believe that the building was used for an entirely different purpose and that they were storehouses or barracks, not stables. And not only that, the level involved was not the time of Solomon, but was the time of Ahab. Now, of course, to get into the details of the reasons for coming to that conclusion is extremely technical, and we won't discuss that here today. But you see that the interpretation of the evidence is not always as simple as it might appear to be, and there can be difference of viewpoint. And interpretations that are given initially may be revised later on the basis of new evidence. So that the interpretation of archaeological evidence may be tentative. We have to keep that in mind. Pritchard says in another article, not the article about the Megiddo's table, but in another article on archaeology and methodology of it, he makes a statement that I think is well worth listening to. He says, rarely, if ever, do historical judgments emerge from the ground. They are usually deduced by archaeologists from observed evidence. Such tangible objects as pots, walls, floors, etc., take on meaning for history only as the context in which they are found can be controlled, identified, and related to other contexts by the excavator and his colleagues. This process of interpretation involves opinion, common sense, logic, and to remember the human variables, the components of any archaeological equation, is to guard against an unwarranted authoritarianism. Now, I think that statement puts in focus the nature of the use of archaeological findings. And you're going to interpret their significance. There are a lot of factors involved. There are judgments involved. There's opinions involved. There may be presuppositions involved about a variety of different things. And there are a lot of variables. And that has to be kept in mind. Another illustration of a shift in interpretation of archaeological evidence can be seen in the discovery of Solomon's copper mines and smelting furnace. Perhaps you've read in a handbook in archaeology of Solomon's blast furnace or his smelting furnace for manufacture of copper. In the late 1930s, Nelson Gluck was exploring the area south of the Dead Sea near Ezion Geber, and that arm of the Red Sea that comes up to where Elath is today in Israel. And he made an interesting discovery. He found that there were rocks there that contained veins of copper and iron ore. And he discovered that that ore was mined during the period of Solomon and shortly afterwards. And he found remains of copper slag in that area. He had really hoped in his excavations and his survey there to find evidence of Solomon's seaport at Ezion Geber, which is mentioned in the Book of Kings. He didn't find that. But he did find another structure that he thought was a smelting furnace or refinery. And he found in this building that there were rooms that had two rows of holes in them, holes in a wall of a building. He interpreted those holes to be flues in which a draft was drawn into the room to the fire that was then used to smelt the ore. The location of the building was such that winds that came down a valley hit the side of that building. Had the building been to one side or to the other, it would have been out of the line of those winds. And he thought it was put there deliberately. These holes were to catch this draft and then to stoke up the fire in that wood. Gluck said in an article at that time that he wrote, and I quote, Ezion Geber was the result of careful planning, was built as a model installation with remarkable architectural and technical skill. In fact, practically the whole town of Ezion Geber, taking into consideration place and time, was a phenomenal industrial site. Without anything to compare with it in the entire history of the ancient Orient, Ezion Geber was the Pittsburgh of old Palestine. And at the same time, its most important seaport. Well, he didn't find the evidence for the seaport. The Bible speaks of it, but he found this building, and he felt here was the first blast furnace in history, Pittsburgh of Palestine. Now, that again, some have used that. Here's corroboration of Solomon's wisdom. He was able to construct such a industrial site. Here's corroboration of the trade that he carried on from this seaport. He would take the copper that was smelted and trade that for other goods. And it's certainly mentioned in the scripture that he did carry on a great trade, and many very exotic things were brought into that port and then overland taken up to Jerusalem. And while all that may be the case, it now appears that Gluck's original interpretation of the use of that building was wrong. In an article in 1965, Gluck says that he and others now think that the holes in the wall are merely the result of decay of or burning of wooden beams, and that those holes had to do simply with the structure of the building, and the beams either burned or decayed, and the hole was simply where they were attached to the wall for support. He says there are numerous analogies to this kind of construction, both inside and outside Palestine, and he has totally given up his original interpretation of what the building was. And he feels that the copper was not fired in that kind of a furnace, but instead it was prepared in small crucibles, heated on charcoal fires, and just small little buttons of copper were made in that way. Well, I think then this illustrates this second principle. When using archaeology in the interpretation and understanding of Scripture, we must remember first the fragmentary nature of the evidence, secondly, the tentative nature of the interpretation of the evidence. And those two principles are of great importance when we utilize archaeology in the interpretation of the historical sections of the Bible. Now, I want to take those two principles and illustrate how they function in respect to a couple passages in the Old Testament. In Genesis 21, verses 22 to 34, we read of a dispute between Abraham and Abimelech of Gerar over the use of a well. Genesis 21, verse 22 and following. And you notice in verse 32 and verse 34, reference is made to the Philistines. You read in verse 32, they made a covenant at Beersheba. Then Abimelech rose up, and Phicol, the chief captain of his host, they returned unto the land of the Philistines. Abimelech was from the land of the Philistines. In verse 34, we read, Abraham sojourned in the Philistines' land many days. Many commentators, when they see this term Philistine in connection with the time of Abraham, say that what we have is an anachronism in this passage. Now, what's an anachronism? An anachronism is something incongruous in the point of time in which it is placed. In other words, it's said by many that there were no Philistines in that southern coastal region of the land of Canaan in the time of Abraham. We know of Philistines in the time of Saul and the time of David, but that was much later. There were not Philistines, we're told, in the time of Abraham, and reference to Philistines is an anachronism in this passage. It's written by someone much later who knew a lot about the Philistines and thought they had always been there, when as a matter of fact, they hadn't always been there. And it's said by many that the Philistines did not come to Canaan, to that area, until about 1200 B.C. That would have been 800 years after the time of Abraham. 1200 would have been sometime after the conquest of Canaan by the Israelites, after they came out of Egypt. Critics would say then that this story was written at a late time, when it was taken for granted the Philistines were always there. So it is historically inaccurate. John Bright, who wrote A History of Ancient Israel, John Bright is a follower of Albright. Generally, he has high regard for the historical reliability of the patriarchal sections of the Old Testament. But here he says, the mentioning of the Philistines is an anachronism. The Philistines arrived somewhat after the Israelite conquest. Now, the reason for taking that position is that there is an inscription in Egypt recording the victory of an Egyptian pharaoh over an invasion of sea peoples that came against Egypt at about 1200. And they were repulsed. And then the assumption is that they went up and settled in the land of Canaan on the coastal region, and they were the Philistines. And these sea peoples then become identified with the Philistines. And this inscription of the Egyptian pharaoh at about 1200 then sets the date for the arrival of the Philistines. Now, What do we do with a question like that? Let me just read a paragraph from Joseph Free's book, which is an excellent little handbook, Archaeology and Bible History, where he makes this statement. Some liberals have held that this reference to Abraham's having dealings with the Philistines about 2000 B.C. is a mistake, since the Philistines apparently came in 1200 B.C. Burroughs of Yale says we have seen that the Philistines came into Palestine at the beginning of the early Iron Age, not far from 1200 B.C. It is quite impossible to date Abraham and Isaac as late as this. Yet the book of Genesis represents both as having dealings with the Philistines and their king Abimelech. Burroughs says this may be explained as a convenient and harmless anachronism, and concludes at any rate, however, the mistake may have come about. However the mistake may have come about, it is undoubtedly a mistake. Now, what Free points out is that the whole liberal argument here is based on silence. As yet, no conclusive archaeological evidence has been unearthed showing that there were Philistines in Palestine in 2000 B.C. Free says it is entirely possible, however, that they were in Palestine at this early date, that their numbers were increased by other Philistines from the Aegean area about 1200 B.C. This last influx is demonstrated by the archaeological discoveries. It is entirely possible that we shall find conclusive archaeological evidence of earlier Philistines in Canaan. Now, it seems to me that what we are confronted with here is this very thing, the fragmentary nature of the evidence. Simply because we do not have archaeological corroboration of Philistines in Canaan at 2000 B.C., does not necessarily mean there were not Philistines in Canaan at 2000 B.C. And to cast any sort of disparaging historical reflection on this narrative in Genesis because we do not have that archaeological corroboration is a violation of this principle of the very fragmentary character of archaeological findings. The fragmentary nature of the evidence means that an unconfirmed biblical statement is not to be considered suspect. Another application of this to biblical material, Joshua chapter 7 and 8 records the conquest of a town called Ai, or sometimes called Ai. Remember, after the Lord gave Jericho into the hands of the Israelites, and Achan took of the things of the town that were forbidden, the Israelites went up against Ai, and they were defeated. And they wondered why. And the Lord pointed out to them someone had violated his command. And Achan was found out, and that issue was taken care of. Then they went up to Ai, and they took the city. That site, Ai, has been considered by most archaeologists to be a mound that is called Et Tel. And that mound has been excavated originally in 1933 to 35, and more recently it's been re-excavated. And the archaeologists have found that the city was destroyed at about 2200 B.C., back before the time of Abraham, and that it was not occupied again except for a small Iron One settlement at about 1200 to 1050. So the history of this mound before 2200, and then for a short period around 1200 to 1050. But that would mean that the site was not inhabited at the time of the Israelite conquest. And of course, then that raises the question of how that archaeological evidence is to be related to the biblical text. Here you have this story of the taking of this city in Joshua. And yet the archaeologists tell us that site wasn't occupied at that time. How do you relate those two? Well, various suggestions have been made. One of the original excavators proposed that Ai was a military outpost of Bethel. Bethel's a very nearby city. And the idea was Ai was a military outpost of Bethel, and the conquest of Ai was actually the overrunning of the military outpost, which would mean that we would not expect evidence of remains of occupation from that mound at that time, because it wasn't really an occupied city as such. It was simply a military outpost. Well, that may sound like a reasonable explanation for the situation, but there's a problem with it. At least one problem, if not more. Notice chapter 12 of Joshua, verse 9, where in verse 9 and following, there are a list of all the kings that were taken by Joshua. We read the king of Jericho won, the king of Ai, which is beside Bethel, won. And then you go down to verse 16, and it says the king of Makeda won, the king of Bethel won. There's a king of Ai and there's a king of Bethel. So that Ai hardly seems like it was a military outpost of Bethel. It seems like a separate little town with its own king. There were these city-states that existed in Palestine at that time, each with its own king, and Ai seems to have been such a town. Albright suggested that the story of the conquest of Ai is really the story of the conquest of nearby Bethel. And that mound that's been excavated was inhabited during this time. And that this became confused in the transmission of the story. So that really, when you read Joshua 7 and 8, you're not reading of the conquest of Ai, you're reading about the conquest of Bethel, and the whole story simply got confused and was related to the wrong town. Again, that's hardly an acceptable suggestion if you hold to the reliability of the historical narratives of the Old Testament, and also the king of Bethel won, the king of Ai won. So what do we do with this? Kenneth Kitchen, in his book Ancient Orient and Old Testament, says, despite assertions sometimes made to the contrary, this situation suggests that Et Tel is not Ai, but another ancient site. And he suggests perhaps Beth Aven. In other words, Kitchen's suggestion is the identification of the site was wrong, and Et Tel is maybe not Ai. And that Ai must be looked for somewhere else in the area, not on Et Tel. When mounds and literary records fail to agree, in other cases, topographers and archaeologists do not panic. They simply use their common sense, recognize they were probably mistaken in their identification, and proceed to search elsewhere in the region. The problem of Ai should be regarded in exactly the same way. I think that's a good suggestion by Kitchen. Of course, it doesn't, at this point, resolve the problem totally. But I think we're involved here with either the absence of evidence, this fragmentary character of evidence, or perhaps the misinterpretation of what evidence there is. But that in no way jeopardizes our confidence in the reliability of the scriptural narrative. Why? Because we realize the limits of archaeological findings, both with respect to their fragmentary nature and the tentativeness of interpretation of existing evidence, in this case, with this particular problem. In 1970, an article was published in the Westminster Theological Journal by David Livingston, who lives over in Huntington Valley, I believe, close by Philadelphia here, in which he suggested an alternative location for Ai. And this summer, he has put together a team and been given permission by the Israeli government to excavate his alternative site. He's taking, I think, about 30 fellows with him, and he wants to see if, in a preliminary examination of this alternative site, any evidence will come to light to suggest that this alternative site really should be considered Ai rather than Et Tel. Now, of course, we await with interest the outcome of this summer's work on that particular problem. Perhaps Livingston will come up with some evidence that would corroborate at this point his hypothesis that this other mound is Ai. As of yet, we don't know. Perhaps he won't come up with evidence. The degree to which interpretation of archaeological evidence is subject to influences deriving from the pre-commitments of the investigators is another important factor to be kept in mind. That can be illustrated in a recent development that appears to signal a new trend in discussions surrounding the relation of archaeological research to the reliability of the patriarchal narratives of the Old Testament. I mentioned at the beginning of this discussion that the trend in the past 25 to 50 years has been to move back towards greater respect for the historical reliability of the patriarchal narratives on the basis of archaeological findings. And generally, that is true. However, recently, a challenge has arisen to that position. I mean, it used to be 150 years ago, the patriarchal traditions were not questioned, higher criticism arose, and everyone said in the scholarly world, these are not valid historical documents. And that dominated the field through the early part of the century. That then there seemed to come a reversal with the results of archaeological research, and there was greater respect, at least among many scholars, for the historical reliability of the patriarchal traditions. But recently, a challenge has arisen to that movement toward greater respect for the patriarchal traditions, and it seems that this new challenge may gain a following. In 1974, a man named T.L. Thompson published a book entitled The Historicity of the Patriarchal Narratives, The Quest for the Historical Abraham. Long title of the book. It's a very technical book. It was published in a very prestigious series of monographs published in Germany. It's the series in the academic world in Germany. It is probably 250, 300 pages, the book. It sells for around $50 a copy, if you'd like to buy a copy. The general thesis of the book is that the substantiation of the historicity of the patriarchal narratives on the basis of the parallels and analogies that have been found through archaeological research is not valid. And the book amounts to a major attack on the view developed by William Foxwell Albright, and then followed by G. Ernest Wright and John Bright, and many other particularly American scholars, who found evidence in all this archaeological research for the historical reliability of the patriarchal narratives. Thompson is attacking all that. Now, it remains to be seen how great an influence Thompson will have. Although if you look through the journals that have reviewed his book in the last couple years, it appears that a number of the reviewers accept his thesis, that he's really established his case, and that the Albright School was all wrong. They misread archaeology. In the review in the Journal of Biblical Literature, this statement is made by the reviewer. In my opinion, Thompson's review, that is, review of this problem, is tantamount to a complete refutation of these arguments. And the arguments are the arguments of Albright. Now, again, I can't enter into the details of this particular discussion here. But the very fact that the discussion is taking place is illustrative of the fact that interpretation of archaeological evidence is an extremely important factor in its use as an aid to understanding Scripture. Gordon Wenham, in an article he wrote on Old Testament criticism, made this statement: archaeological results are not facts which speak for themselves. Archaeological evidence is meaningful to a historian only when it is integrated and in the interpretation, subjective bias may enter in. Archaeological facts and results don't speak for themselves. and subjective bias may enter in this whole process of interpretation and use of archaeological findings. The interpretation of archaeological evidence and the assessment of its significance may vary from scholar to scholar, and it does. It may vary from time to time. You seem to get these trends, and they seem to change from time to time. They may vary from country to country. Generally, in America, there's much more positive assessment of the role of archaeology than there has been in Germany, for example. Archaeology usually does not speak with one voice, and it does not speak with unequivocal terms. And it's important for us to recognize this in our own use of archaeological evidence. Archaeological research, like any other human endeavor, is subject to error. And while we can appreciate and utilize the light which it can throw on biblical interpretation, and which it has thrown on biblical interpretation, we must always remember to keep its role in biblical interpretation in a proper perspective. It has contributed greatly in the past 50 years to the establishment of a much higher regard for the reliability of biblical historiography, in spite of Thompson's claims to the contrary. I think that statement still stands. And that's of great importance. We don't want to minimize that. And certainly there is good precedent to expect that with continued research, new findings will be brought to light that will cast more light on the biblical record and will increasingly vindicate and corroborate biblical history. And that is of particular importance for Christianity and for the Christian faith. Because the Christian faith is inseparably related to the historical events recorded in the Bible, the climax in the life and death and resurrection of Christ. There's no way to separate our faith from the actuality of these events that are recorded in the Bible. And it's right at that point that someone like Thompson has gone astray, because Thompson's book is not simply a book that attacks the analysis of the archaeological findings and their relationship to the patriarchal period. He has a whole theology that's related to his approach to this question. According to Thompson, the stories in Genesis, quote, are not historical, nor do they intend to be historical. They are rather historically determined expressions about Israel and Israel's relationship to its God, given in forms legitimate to their time. Their truth lies not in their facticity, nor in their historicity, but in their ability to express the reality that Israel experienced. And he says further, in respect to the commitment of faith, the question is not whether we take history seriously. The question of whether the Bible is a true source of faith will not be decided on the basis of the Bible's historical acceptability. Salvation history is not a historical account of saving events open to the study of the historian. Salvation history did not happen. It is a literary form which has its own historical context. Now, you see, that involves a whole view of what the whole character of the Bible and the character of faith is. He says salvation history did not happen. It's a literary form. And over against that view of the nature of faith and its relation to history, we must assert with all the force that we can that biblical faith is a response to God's words and acts in history. And if those words were not spoken, and if the acts did not occur, then our faith is vain. In a recent issue of the News Exchange, published by the Reformed Ecumenical Synod, May 8, 1979, just last month. A report is given of a Jewish-Christian dialogue held in Germany for 120 teachers of religion. And in the dialogue, liberal Christian scholars took one side of the debate, and they took the side of Rudolf Bultmann's demythologization approach to the narratives of the New Testament, and declared that the resurrection of Christ was a myth. And interestingly enough, the actual happening or occurrence of the resurrection was defended by Dr. Pinchas Lapida, religious science and theology professor at Jerusalem University. He's a Jewish scholar who said, and I quote, "Without a factual historical event, there is no act of faith." That's interesting. And of course, that's what we would maintain as well. Without a factual historical event, there is no act of faith. How can you talk about faith if these things did not occur? He went on to say, just as there would have been no Judaism without the Sinai event, so there would have been no Christendom without the Easter event. And again, something with which we can completely agree. The historical events recorded in the biblical narratives are presented in the Bible as the unfolding of God's great plan of redemption for a fallen human race. Because these events, as they relate to the patriarchs, Moses, the nation of Israel, and so on, are intermeshed in the currents of the flow of human history during the first two millennia B.C., we may expect that they can be illuminated and in certain instances corroborated by archaeological research. And while it's true that there are important aspects of the Christian faith which transcend archaeological confirmation or denial, it is not true that the Bible places a dichotomy between religious truth and historical truth. And that's what many of these contemporary scholars are doing, saying that there's a certain realm in which things can be true in the sense of faith or in the sense of religion. And you put that in one realm and you have a historical investigation over in another realm, and the two have nothing to do with each other. And you don't need an actual happening as far as all of these biblical narratives in order to have faith. That's not the way the Bible presents things. The Bible presents faith as that response to God's acts in history, His word in history. G. Wenham has noted that although the theology of the biblical writers is not proved by the historicity of their narrative, it would be invalidated if the events or situations it professes to explain could be shown never to have occurred. Thus, modern historians cannot prove the biblical theologies of history, but they can, in principle, disprove. If you can disprove the events upon which our faith rests, then, in the words of Paul, our faith is in vain. If Christ be not raised, our faith is vain. So genuine biblical faith is inseparably linked with the historical events on which it rests. And for that reason, any evidence that directly or indirectly serves to corroborate biblical history is of importance. And the general trend towards new respect for the historicity of the Bible in the last 20 years or 50 years as a result of archaeological research is certainly a welcome reversal to the skepticism of the early part of this century. And I think we can look with expectation to that continuing to be the case.
Other helpful cassettes are available from Biblical Theological Seminary. We minister to people through our graduate and postgraduate degree programs, our community evening school, our cassette ministry, special seminars, and a free publication, Biblical Bulletin, containing interesting articles by biblical faculty members. For a free cassette catalog or more information about the seminary, please write to Biblical Theological Seminary, 200 North Main Street, Hatfield, Pennsylvania, zip code 19440.